Good morning. I want to give you a little qualifier before I begin, and that is that I really know nothing about what I'm going to be talking to you guys about. But there is a PhD guy on the Loma Linda campus, and I kept trying to get a hold of him. I really wanted to talk to him and glean information from him. And I got him on the phone, and you know what he told me? He said, "I really don't know anything about this kind of stuff." And he teaches it. So I was like, okay, it gave me confidence. The blind leading the blind. Okay, we are going to be talking about what has been called the second brain. And we're going to begin in the Word of God. "Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, and long suffering." What is Paul referring to when he uses the word bowels? No one wants to. The inner parts. Okay. Lamentations 1:20. "Behold, O Lord, for I am in distress. My bowels are troubled, and my heart is turned within me." So here we see bowels and heart having a sympathetic relationship with each other, experiencing the same thing. In the spirit of prophecy, we see the same connection being made between our intestinal tract and what we're experiencing in our mind. And she says this, "The brain and nerves are in sympathy with the stomach. The nerves of the brain are diseased." Is there a place where we don't want to become diseased as we get older? Yeah, you can take my arm and my leg, but please make sure that my brain somehow stays healthy, right? "The brain and the nerves are in sympathy with the stomach. The nerves of the brain are diseased by the abuse heaped on the stomach." Isn't that bizarre? The diseased stomach affects the entire nervous system, the brain, and mind. How does this take place? Then there's this one. "The success of acquiring a good memory and a calm, uniform temper depends not upon circumstances, but very much upon the way in which the stomach is treated." How are we treating our stomachs? And how is it affecting what's going on up here? A calm, uniform temper, acquiring a good memory, something that we all desire to have and possess. Now, I wondered as I read these statements, is this taking things a little bit too far? Did Ellen White read those verses in the Bible and just, you know, what was supposed to be metaphorical, she took literal? Do you think that was what was taking place? No. So the question is, can this influence that? Most certainly. Now, you and I live in an era where empirical evidence and data is important, right? We want evidence. We want to see the cause and effect. We want observable experimentation done so that we can be convinced that indeed this is true. Empirical data. We haven't had any empirical data yet, have we? Well, for you and I, we do, because we believe in the Word of God. We believe in the spirit of prophecy. But we're just going to add to it today, okay? We're going to see what is being studied out there that actually is lending itself to understand what is meant by the statements that we just read. So when we look into what we're going to term the gut is basically defined as your GI tract. Everything that this hollow tube that extends from your mouth all the way to your anus. Everything that goes on inside of that tube is considered really an out-of-body experience. We tend to think of anything behind this skin is within my body, but you know, this is how some scientists refer to it, is the tube that's within the body, and yet it's external. It's kind of self-contained. The gut, and it involves our stomach, intestines, our colon. Now, after we eat, the food enters into our mouth, it goes down the esophagus, it's there in the stomach where it's churned with hydrochloric acid, and that acid is extremely important. We tend to think that, oh, the more alkaline our stomach is, the better, and that's not the way God created it. He wanted the stomach to be acid, because in an acidic environment, your protein is going to be able to be digested better, your B12 is going to be released from its carriers, and the enzymes and the things that are working in the stomach to help break food down work at their best in a very acidic environment. There's acid there for a reason. So it stays in there, and then little by little it's excreted into the small intestine where the pH is adjusted and bile is excreted and more good enzymes to continue digestion through the intestinal tract. And there we see the small intestine, incredible surface area, because in the small intestine, not only are things broken down, but substances, nutrients important for our health are absorbed into the body. And not only do we have 22 approximately feet of this small intestine running through us, but then there's all these folds within these 22 feet, you know, creating this extremely large surface area. But then on each one of those folds, you'll see these little finger-like projections called villi. So there's these villi then lining the small intestine. And then on top of each one of these villi are microvilli. So we're talking, wow, whoever engineered this really was thinking, how can we get the most surface area into this compact situation? And here you see blood vessels going through the villi and lymphatic vessel so that when things are absorbed, they enter into the blood and into the lymph and then become a part of our blood. The microvilli are actually called the brush border. And if you've gone to aquariums or you've gone scuba diving and you see sea anemones and them kind of going like this through the water that's passing by, and I love this picture. I thought it was so beautiful. This is a really close down, right, picture of the microvilli. But doesn't it kind of look like sea anemones? And there they are as the chyme is passing through. That's what it's called after it's entered your stomach, the food, and it's left. As it's passing through the small intestine, those little microvilli are absorbing all the nutrients that are passing by, and it's just this beautiful process that God created. So that's what we already referred to. But there's something more. There's something more that we are going to be addressing today, and that is here we see a cross-section of the small intestine and the central lumen there where the chyme is passing through and the villi that are surrounding it. But then once you start getting into the actual wall of the small intestine, we start seeing nerves. All these nerves are innervating the linings of the walls, the sections of this small intestine. What are those nerves accomplishing? Well, they're promoting digestion, right? In order for digestion to occur, we need muscular action. Whenever there's muscular action, there's nerve innervation. So we can say, well, that's what's going on, but there's more. This nervous system within our gut is called the enteric nervous system. Technically known as the enteric nervous system, it consists of sheaths of neurons embedded in the walls of the long tube of our gut, from the esophagus to the end of our intestines, referred to by scientists as the second brain. The enteric nervous system is said to contain about 100 million neurons more than in either the spinal cord or the peripheral nervous system. So we know that the spinal cord, right, has all these nerves going in it, and then the peripheral nervous system is when the nerves shoot out to my arms and my legs and extend throughout my body outside of that central nervous system. But your gut, the enteric nervous system, has more neurons than the central nervous system in the periphery. What is its function? We mentioned digestion. It's an interesting thing when you are digesting food and assimilating food that those microvilli and those villi in the small intestines, they absorb food in proportion to your need. If you are deficient in a nutrient, it's going to absorb a lot more of that nutrient from the food that you are eating. So it somehow can detect, there's a deficiency, we need more. It's going to increase that suction power when it gets to it. It also knows if you're one of those people that really believes in vitamin C, and when you measure vitamin C, how much we need per day, it's in milligrams. But some people are taking like 12 grams of vitamin C. Do you know how much of that you're actually absorbing? Your body's saying, whoa, that's just way too much. So it puts the kind of damper on, so you're only absorbing about 16%. You're still getting a lot, right? But you're only absorbing, whereas if you were to take in only a little bit of vitamin C, probably just a normal daily amount of what you're supposed to be taking in with fruits and vegetables, then you're going to be absorbing maybe 90% of that vitamin C. So somehow there's detection going on and an understanding. I'm not going to say thinking because it's not like thinking, right? But somehow it knows what's going on and it responds accordingly. So the next one is absorption. We talked about that. It controls secretions. So it also can detect how much fat I've eaten and says, okay, this much fat, this is how much bile we need to excrete. This much food, this is how many enzymes I need to excrete. So it has all that somehow logged and knows how to respond accordingly, a well-functioning machine. It senses environmental threats. We all know about that. Protection, it protects us. Immune responses. The gut is a really powerful immune organ, and it responds with inflammation. Can work both independently and in conjunction with the brain. So they have found that if you were to take the vagus nerve, which runs from your gut up to your brain, and if they were to sever that, your gut would still work. Now we think of the brain, right? The brain is the master control, where it tells, it dictates, and it governs everything else that's taking place below the neck. However, they found that the stomach can work independently. It can still do its job. The intestines, they will still do their job and function even if the master control isn't telling it what to do. So the brain, the nerves, and the enteric nervous system, there are several different kinds of nerves. This is just kind of a basic schematic structure that's been enlarged just on that one section to show how neurons communicate with each other. So here we see that the kind of end that looks like maybe what you've pulled out of the ground in terms of roots, thank you, that those are the dendrites that receive an information, and that message is passed as an electrical signal down the axon through that sheath that's covered with myelin, fatty fat, covering the sheath of the axon, and it's very important, that fatty sheath that makes the signals pass quickly and efficiently. When there's damage done to those sheaths, we have diseases like multiple sclerosis, right? So here we go down. The electrical signal actually then stimulates chemicals at the end to be released. And those chemicals are released, specific chemicals, according to that electrical signal, and then they are received by the next neuron, which that converts those chemicals into another electrical signal, and it keeps going down the path, wherever it's going, from chemical to electrical to chemical and so forth. So this is kind of how it works, and there you just see another picture, but a maybe closer up picture of those neurotransmitters, they're called, very important in sending the message, and then receptors on the other end for those specific neurotransmitters. Just another picture to show the synapses as the site of this activity. So this picture, I actually don't like this picture. It's very disturbing to me because the brain is the brain. It's the head. Don't lower the head, right? Some of these women issues that are going on right now, I'm like, you know, God said in His Word there was a head. Let's leave the head, and I'll do my part. So I don't like this picture too much, but there's a reason why people have drawn this. And that's what we want to find out. Why are people calling the enteric nervous system the second brain? Why have they labeled it as such? So here we see the brain is made of neurons. The enteric nervous system, made of neurons. The brain is also composed of glial cells, which are kind of the nurses of those neurons, and they protect the neurons and glial cells in the enteric nervous system. In the brain, we have neurotransmitters, and I just listed the two that I think are probably the most familiar to all of us. We understand serotonin and dopamine, and neurotransmitters in the enteric nervous system, serotonin and dopamine. But not only does the enteric nervous system have serotonin and dopamine, but it contains 90% of the serotonin in your body. And you think, it's not up here? No. 90% of your serotonin is down here. Dopamine, the cells in your enteric nervous system produce 50% of the dopamine in your body. Are there receptors for neuropeptides or those chemicals of emotion in your brain? Yes, there's those receptors. That's why we feel, have moods, and think. Are those same receptors found in the enteric nervous system? Yes, they are there. In the brain, we have a blood-brain barrier. In the enteric nervous system, they found a blood-gut barrier. Very interesting. So serotonin, we think of or we relate to as the feel-good neurotransmitter that when people experience depression, they are many times prescribed antidepressant that influences the amount of serotonin in their brains so that it will lift their moods. Then serotonin is also involved, though, in sleep regulation, in control of appetite, memory, learning, temperature regulation, mood and behavior, also very important in bone density, cardiovascular function, muscle contraction, and endocrine regulation, where we're just talking about hormones when we use the word endocrine. Dopamine, it's a neurotransmitter that helps control the brain's reward and pleasure centers. When people smoke, it tastes bad, it smells disgusting, but what happened in their brain? Dopamine was released, and wow, that sure felt good. Let's try that again. Helps regulate the movement and emotional responses. So the gut's enteric nervous system, we're just going to kind of recap, okay? Has a massive amount of neurons stretching from your esophagus to your anus. It's made up of various types of neurons with glial support cells. Has more receptors for neuropeptides of emotion than the brain. It's the largest immune organ of the body. Produces a wide range of hormones and around 40 neurotransmitters of the same classes as those found in the brain. The neurons in the gut are thought to generate as much dopamine as those in the head, and about 90% of the serotonin present in the body at any time is in the enteric nervous system. Are you impressed yet?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Are you ready to call it the second brain? Okay. So Parkinson's is a disease that manifests itself as progressive tremors, slowed movement, muscles start, I don't know if it's atrophying, but they're no longer functional. And it's this progressive disease, and people have gone into the brains of Parkinson's patients after they have passed away, and they have found Lewy bodies. And they're these protein clumps in neurons of the brain that produce dopamine. So there's these Lewy bodies, and they're associated with Parkinson's and with dementia. Well, there's this man by the name of Heiko Brock, and he is from the Institute of Clinical Neuroanatomy in Germany, and he has found that these Lewy bodies are, guess where? In the dopamine-producing neurons of your gut. So much so there that from his perspective, this is kind of what he's put out there, is that he thinks that it actually, Parkinson's actually begins in the gut as the result of an environmental trigger and then spreads to the brain. Now, interestingly, they have found the same thing with Alzheimer's, that the same tangles and the same amyloid plaques that we see in the brain have also been found in the gut. Now, no one has tried to make an association with this that I know of, but it's still very strange, isn't it? It's still very, very strange. Irritable bowel syndrome. Now, what I was taught this last year was that irritable bowel syndrome is not a disease. It's more like what we'd call psychosomatic, that basically is maybe a medical way of saying it's all in your head. It's a syndrome. Now, do the people experience, do 2 million people in America who have irritable bowel syndrome think this is all in my head? No, they're experiencing, you know, a lot of intestinal distress. Anxiety and depression are thought to contribute to irritable bowel syndrome and dyspepsia, but our studies are showing that it may be the other way around. So we want to say, oh, you're stressed out, you've got too much turmoil up here, and it's affecting this, right? But Now, someone, gastroenterologist neuroscientist Jay Peruska, is saying, we're thinking it might go the other way. And this guy's not a dummy. He's at Johns Hopkins. So gastrointestinal irritation might actually spur the mood changes common in these patients. Brain-gut communication likely works both ways, he says. A characteristic feature of disorders such as irritable bowel syndrome or functional dyspepsia is their association with psychological problems such as anxiety or depression. The current thinking generally is that the latter, the psychological problems and the anxiety, cause or exacerbate gastrointestinal symptoms, right? So this is causing this. And we all know about that. We're nervous, we're stressed, and we feel uptight down here. We sought, through his research, he's a researcher on this subject, and he says, we sought an alternative explanation, namely that gastrointestinal problems cause depression and anxiety. Thus, both long-lasting pain and psychological problems can result from a single cause, gastric irritation, if it occurs in vulnerable individuals. So this was kind of what he was thinking, and then he went to experiment on the mice, or the rats. And what he did was he took these rats who were 8 to 10 days old, and he irritated their stomach. He irritated their stomach every single day for six days. And then he waited till they were all grown up, 8 to 10 weeks old now, and what he found was that the rats whose stomachs had been irritated were more likely than their peers to display depressed and anxious behaviors, while the symptoms continued even though this had been healed long ago, right? He wasn't irritating it, any localized irritation, any redness or, you know, cellular damage had been locally, that had been healed up long ago, but all of a sudden he's seeing in these same mice ramifications in our lifetime, if we were to equate it years later. The majority of patients with anxiety and depression will also have alterations of their GI function. They are connected. Now, as I was trying to find out how they were connected and, you know, what was taking place physiologically, this is where I kept ending up. And it's called the microbiota gut-brain axis. Microbiota gut-brain axis. And what that basically is referring to is the microbiota is all the bacteria, all the microorganisms that inhabit and live, that have colonized in our GI tract, in our gut. And that these communicate, these microbes communicate with the gut, but also the brain. So this is what this is referring to, the microbiota gut-brain axis. So we talked about the gut and what that means. We looked even closer at it in terms of what it's composed of and how it works and the villi and the microvilli and how small those things are, how they absorb. We looked at the enteric nervous system, the nerves that are surrounding that, getting the information there. And yet now we're looking even closer. Now we're looking even deeper at our individual microbiome, which is, if we were to each take a swab somehow of all the bacteria and microorganisms in our guts, they would all be unique. They're as unique as your fingerprint in terms of what's colonizing and in what proportions are down there. So the idea that bacteria teeming in the gut, collectively known as the microbiome, can affect not only the gut but also the mind has just catapulted on the scene. Researchers are like, whoa, what is this? What association? What's going on here? How is this explaining anything? This is from a neuroimmunologist. In just the last few years, evidence has mounted from studies in rodents that the gut microbiome can influence neural development, brain chemistry, and a wide range of behavioral phenomena, including emotional behavior, pain perception, and how the stress system responds. Did these people read The Spirit of Prophecy? No. Where are they getting this information from? from empirical evidence, right? They're just like looking and they're researching and they're saying, what is going on here? There was to exist a symbiotic relationship. There is to exist, and there is existing a symbiotic relationship, meaning that both parties are mutually benefiting the other one, between the microbes in our gut and our brain. And I do like this picture. I thought it was kind of cute that these guys are in some way altering maybe the color or some way doing whatever they are in what was supposed to be a nurturing, helpful situation. And it's a good thing because the microorganisms outnumber us. There are more of them than there are of us, if you could kind of try to wrap your mind around that one. But there's more microorganisms than cells of your body. What they do insignificantly impacts us. So we have, very simply, the good guys, and we have the bad. Here you see the good guys, friendly bacteria, and they look like they're just kind of polishing the villi in your gut. And then we have the bad guys. And when the bad guys overpopulate the good guys, that's when we have, all of us have good guys and bad guys in our gut. And the good guys, when we're feeding them and they're thriving and they're creating this healthy, wonderful environment, they're going to keep the bad guys at bay. They're going to keep them, you're down there, okay? But when we feed the bad guys and we neglect to feed the good guys, then the balance gets tipped. And then they start ruling the roost, and that's when we start having problems. Researchers found that tweaking the balance between beneficial and disease-causing bacteria in an animal's gut can alter that animal's brain chemistry. Yeah, just like, how does that happen? So this microbiome, when what we've typically thought of as its function, this is what we're just going to list right here. This is what we've normally thought of that it does. It trains and stimulates your immune system. Very important. They gave students certain probiotics. I can't remember if it was in yogurt or as a pill, but they found that their T cells upped and their immune system was just a little more heightened. Prevents growth of harmful species, produces vitamins and hormones, which direct storage of fats. And I think it was last year or the year before we talked about with mice, when they took fat mice and skinny mice and they injected the fat mice gut bacteria, don't ask me how they did that, into the skinny mice, into their gut, the skinny mice kind of went boop. And then when they took the skinny mice microbiome and they injected it into the fat mice, then the fat mice went, interesting, right? So here we see, which direct storage of fats. Don't do this, but they are doing that with people. I mean, if you need it, I guess. I don't know enough about it. Maintains balanced inflammatory response, crucial, like we looked at yesterday, as a foundation for so many different diseases, and reinforces your intestinal barrier, provides us with energy, protects the body against disease-causing microorganisms, regulates bowel movements, helps prevent bloating, gas, and yeast overgrowth, produces hundreds of neurochemicals that relate to learning, memory, and mood. This is just what researchers are now finding out, that they're saying, we are seeing neurochemicals we've never seen before. Our gut is producing mind-altering substances. That's what they're saying. So this was some research done. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2011, in which they took mice, divided them in two, and they fed half the mice a broth, and this broth was laced with Lactobacillus rhamnosus. Okay, not important that we know the name. It's just a microbe that's frequently touted for its probiotic qualities. It's a good, one of the good guys, okay? So they put some broth, put some good guy in there, gave that to half of the mice. The other mice got the broth without the good guy in it. And then they subjected these mice to kind of stress tests. But they first put them in the maze, and they found that the mice who had gotten the broth with the probiotic in it, that they were more bold. They would stand out in the maze and be more aggressive and look around, more confident, I guess is the word, rather than aggressive, to explore and to attempt the maze. When they put them in water, they put them in this forced swim test, they found that the mice who had been drinking the broth with the added substance in it, that they didn't give up. They didn't just start floating, but they just kept going. Seemed like these mice, according to these researchers, had less anxiety. They also found that in brain regions, in the brain, that the number of receptors for GABA, so we're just going to call it GABA, and it is a neurotransmitter that keeps anxiety in check. So these mice receiving this formula were producing more neurotransmitter receptor sites, so that more activity was going on with this one neurotransmitter that was resulting in reduced anxiety. Did we get that? So just as gut bacteria is affecting the brain also exerts a powerful influence on gut bacteria. As many studies have shown, even mild stress can tip the microbial balance in the gut, making the host more vulnerable to infectious disease and triggering a cascade of molecular reactions that feed back to the central nervous system. So again, they tried this on animals and they found this in people as well. They took mama monkeys, pregnant monkeys, and that, you know how the Spirit of Prophecy says that of all the times when a woman, you know, should be happy and stress-free, it should be when she has, when she's with child. And they found that when they took these pregnant monkeys and they stressed them out every once in a while, that their babies, after they had their babies had much less of the good guys, we'll call it that. But they checked their bacterial world and they found their bacterial balance had been upset, that they actually had less of the good guy population, which was very interesting. One with the stressed out mice, they put these mice in with other mice who were extremely aggressive, and it was like a social stressor, you know, to be kind of like us being thrown down into some LA district that was shooting all the time. You know, all of a sudden we'd be stressed out. And so that's what happened to these mice. And again, they found that it affected their microbial world, that it tamped down beneficial bacteria, decreased the overall diversity of the gut microbiome, and promoted the overall growth of harmful bacteria, and that these mice also experienced inflammation in the gut. Now, the other picture, sorry, I also wanted to comment on the students, that they have found that college students during exam week, again, that their gut flora is very different from like the first day of the semester when you're like, oh, you're just getting your books and everything's okay, versus, I've been studying all night or I've been studying for days and now I'm taking this test that I feel like is so important. So stress does impact then what's taking place within. Now at birth, before birth, when we're in mother's womb, our gut is sterile. And the inoculation that gets our gut going is supposed to take place through the birth canal. As we are being born, baby is being inoculated with all this good bacteria so that baby comes out into the world and is giving a fighting chance against everything else that's out there, right? But what has doubled in the amount, yes, you guys are jump ahead of me. So now we're having C-sections, we're having optional C-sections, not just emergency. C-sections are there for a reason, save the baby, save the mother, right? Very important that that comes first. But now we're having all these optional C-sections. Just take it out of there the easy way, okay? Right? Or I want to get this over with. I need to go play golf. So we're having all these C-sections that are taking place. But you know who it's hurting is the baby. The baby is not getting inoculated. So the baby comes into the world kind of at a disadvantage and has a much harder time than with, and plus nursing. Nursing also is a part of the process of inoculating the baby with good bacteria and that contact. And so when we are missing both of those elements, then the child is going to suffer. And the diversity and this health of their gut microbiome is affected. And then you just can't help but wonder, based on just what we've been learning, how does that affect them later on in life, right? What happens to this? Certain bacteria flourish when they get the right kind of food and others languish. We kind of mentioned that already. What happens when things get imbalanced? A zillion things. We've talked about them, actually talked about it last year too, the physiological things. And now this year we're touching on, this brain-gut association. The question that we want to ask is, how can we keep it balanced? Well, we've already talked about the initiation, you know, the birth process, the breastfeeding, but then our diet and our lifestyle and the stress levels and our sleep and everything that we have been taught and know impacts us, not just our immune system like we've thought about, but how our gut, what's surviving down there, what's the balance of this microbiome. So diets that are very high in fiber, we've always thought that fiber was this non-nutritious substance, right? We don't need fiber. Who needs fiber? We don't digest it anyway, right? It's not broken down. Well, you know who lives off fiber? The good guys. They love fiber. And so they ferment it and they break it down and they take whatever they do with it, and that makes them survive and thrive and healthy. And do you know what the bad guys love? Sugar and all the processed American foods that we have become so accustomed to consuming. So when our diets are high in those kind of foods, guess what our gut is going to look like, right? We can tip the balance. And we can also, and also all the antibiotics and the medications, these are affecting our microbial world as well. Thankfully, we can reboot. Thankfully, there are probiotics out there. Thankfully, we can change the way we eat and change our microbiome in the process. So our brain and digestive system are closely linked. The Word of God showed us that, and it can turn for our good. Check this out. For we have great joy and consolation in your love, because the bowels of the saints are refreshed by you. I see you guys, and my bowels are just refreshed. I made happy, right? It's affecting me in a positive way. We've kind of shown how it can affect us in a negative way, but the bowels can influence us in a positive way. Again, oopsie, James will be embarrassed. How can I go back? There was another Bible verse on it, and I don't remember which one I wrote, but thank you. We'll end on this slide. Yea, brother, let me have joy of you in the Lord. Refresh my bowels in the Lord. And I hope that that's our experience. Thank you.
This message was presented at the 2014 Lightbearers Convocation. The theme was Faith to Faith, through which we explored the beautiful message of righteousness by faith. The mission and passion of Lightbearers is publishing, training, and evangelism. To learn how you can partner with us or hear other messages like this, visit us online at lightbearers.org. You can also call us at 1-877-585-1111 or write to us at Lightbearers, 37457 Jasper Lowell Road, Jasper, Oregon 97438. It's through your prayers and generosity that we're able to do what we do. Thank you for listening.